Well, howdy there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. Of course, I'm Cam Hale, the mad scientist here behind the mic, and as always, fresh back from his Pokemon encounters, sipping out of his strawberry shortcake cup, es mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filio Filson, master of the Pokeball. Kyle, how are you doing, sir?
I am doing awesome. Before we get on to the Pokemon talk, I have to say, several people have sent this to us, and I really appreciate it. But the FBI announced on Tuesday that it's no longer investigating the longtime mystery of the skyjacker known as D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Something we've come back and discussed it after we've covered it. Now lay it on us. What's going on right quick?
Well, we did an episode on it just recently.
Yeah.
45 years after he vanished at the back of a Boeing 727 into the freezing Northwest rain, wearing only a business suit, a parachute, and a pack filled with $200,000 in cash.
Sunglasses, half a pack of smokes, and a full tank of gas.
Yeah, they've had, a reward, a ransom, if you can give them any clues, and it's been 45 years and nothing's ever happened, so they're just dropping it.
So they're done.
If he's alive still, he's successfully. Apparently, if you do a crime like this and you can hold out for 45 years, they quit looking.
Yeah, right? My hat's off to you, sir. Hey. Before we go any further with the news or any of this stuff, I gotta let you folks listening on a crazy part of my life, okay? First of all, there's nothing I think funnier than an adult falling down. And I don't mean like a handicapped adult or something. I'm talking like just an average healthy adult tripping and falling. But that's not what happened to me. Listen what happened to me. All right, look. I'm a happily married man, this whole thing. So I pull up the other day. This has just happened this past week, man. You gotta get this. Now for breakfast, I'm trying to take care of myself, trying not to eat as much as I was, had me some granola. And I'm eating, and I pull up to this convenience store, I get some gas, and I pull up, and I'm going to go inside, and I'm going to get me a big bottle of water, right?
Right.
And as I pull up, and I look through the doors, there is a girl in there, and she can't be more than 23, 24 years old, stunning. I mean, like, this girl's beautiful. Like, I'm like, what are you doing working in a convenience store at the gas station? I'm blown away.
Right.
So then, you know, instantly you're like, okay, I got to go in there. I got to not look like the troll that I am. So you're like, you try to suck it in, you try to walk in looking, you don't want this young chick looking at you like, look at this old sucker. So I go in, you know, and I'm real smooth, you know, and she's like, hey, and I'm like, hello. And then she's kind of looking at me funny. So I'm like, yeah, that's right. I still got it. So I'm strolling in. I get my water. I go back up to the thing and I put my water up. And she's like, get this smirk on her face. And she goes, is that going to be all, sir? I'm like, you got it, darling. That'll be all. And I check out and I'm thinking, yeah, she's like, all right. I like the guy and his big beard and all that. And I check out and she goes, you might want to dust your beard off. And I'm like, what? And I walk out. And there is so much crunchy, crushed granola. It looks like I've slept in an ashtray with the granola. And she's looking at me like I'm a pathetic sack of crap that I am. So I'm like, bump, bump, ba bump. I'm just like, back to the car, back to life. That's the reason I'm hideous. I can't even take care of myself. You know, you're trying to look cool. And you just don't look cool. Like you're trying to walk real smooth and you trip and fall or you stumble. That's pretty much reality set back in.
You're not the only one that does dumb things. This just happened to me. And this is one of the things where like you don't want to tell anybody because you're like, well, I don't really know. That's kind of embarrassing. But you guys are family. And so I'll say it. And this is a little odd. I was outside. This was like 2 weeks ago.
Uh-oh.
I was grilling. And I was just by myself. Nobody was here. I think it was just me here at the house. And I had my iPhone in my pocket. With some earbuds on, listening to one of my favorite new podcasts. And I got so involved listening to this that at some point I started thinking, well, where's my phone? And I started looking all over the house, all over the studio, and I started looking in my car. And then it kind of dawned on me, I'm listening to a podcast with my phone. And you're like, holy cow, am I retarded?
Yeah, I'm a total idiot.
Yeah, so I'm an idiot. It's one of those things that's kind of funny because you're like, I can't believe how.
It's because you're old.
Yeah, I guess so.
And you're slipping.
Been knocked out too many times or something. I don't know. But moving on to other silly and stupid things, this Pokemon Go has got to go. I mean, this is ridiculous. Now, you know, all over the parks and towns and nature reserves and other areas, green belts, everything. All these people are walking around playing this Pokemon Go. And we mentioned it on the Elite Show on Thursday about several people have fallen off cliffs. There's been numerous car wrecks because of it. It's ridiculous. But one of the things that's funny is in the very beginning, there was a lot of conspiracy theorists that come up and said that, you know, this thing looks sketchier. Whoever designed this, it looks pretty sketchy. So I was like, what are they talking about? So I started looking into it. And they're actually right. I mean,
Whoa. So what you're saying, all right, so you're saying there is something to this Pokemon app, this sketchiness, this what people are conspirating or conspiracy theory behind it.
Yeah, well, you know, I, of course, all jokes aside, I don't have it, but I was looking at some of the privacy policy that you have to read before you can join and download this app.
Okay.
And check this out. This is what it says. It says if you download this Pokemon Go app, one of the things you have to agree with is we cooperate with the government and law enforcement officials or private parties to enforce and comply with the law. We may disclose any information about you or your authorized child that is in use or possession or control to the government or law enforcement officials or private parties as we, in our sole discretion, believe necessary or appropriate. So, I mean, they're basically saying you're giving them permission and they can do whatever they want. What's their stuff?
Well, like what you and I were laughing about, I believe, on the Elite show and stuff, and we've laughed about it a bunch, is whenever you have your video camera and you're waving it around and all that stuff, like, oh, they're filming the inside of everybody's houses. Well, I've always wondered this, is like, if you have something illegal going on, say you're some, you know, maybe an old meth head or something, you're sitting around, you're filming your meth lab and all that stuff, I wonder if there's any way of them finding that, and then... I don't know.
I'm sure they hit me. There was a guy was Facebooking him driving around drinking, and he was arrested.
Yeah, but this is one of those things that not everybody sees that video except where it's going.
Right.
You know, but I'm sure they're capturing it. So
when you give permission, when you want this, when you want to put this app on your phone, you're giving Google permission use any way they seem fit. And it also said that, I mean, basically, if you're out looking for Squirtle, they could be reading your emails because it's all tied in with your Gmail account.
Wow.
So a lot of people don't realize, and so there's a lot of conspiracy theorists that say, well, that's awfully funny. It looks like they're trying to capture all the video and everything inside mm-hmm. of everyone's house. Well, here's what's even stranger. The guy that wrote the program or the company that wrote the program for this app actually used to be like a spook for the NSA.
Really?
The Pokemon Go app was actually created by a company called Ninotic, which was formed by a man named John Hank. Now, Hank also just so happened to found a company called Keyhole. And what is Keyhole, do you ask? Well, I'll tell you if you go to Keyhole's website, but you can't. That's because it was bought by Google back in 2004. But before that, Keyhole received funding from a firm called InQtel, which was a government-controlled ventures capital firm that invests in companies that will help beef up Big Brother's tool belt. What's more, the funds for InQtel gave Keyhole mostly came from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or the NGA. Whose primary mission is, get this, collecting, analyzing, and distributing geospatial intelligence. So basically, the guy used to work for a company that made software that was doing this very thing.
Specializing in this.
Capturing video and everything and using that. So what I thought was just a crazy conspiracy theory might have a little bit of truth to it.
There's some validity to it. Yeah,
so if any of you people that have Pokemon Go on your phone, I would get rid of it as soon as possible.
When you first brought up Keyhole, I thought that used to be a company you worked for, but it was called Glory Hole, so I couldn't remember that one. So, yeah. Well, yeah, you never know. Man's got to do what a man's got to do to get through college. Anyhow, dude, you're going to dig this. Remember we were talking about, we've always talked about the idea of ancient surviving cultures spreading around basically what was thought to be lost, I guess you could say technology or lost understanding. And we used to always talk about farming. Right. You would bring up with the knowledge, the lost knowledge, the lost ability to farm. People talk about us being hunter-gatherers because that's the way we had to survive for the longest time. Well, popularchaeology.com actually came out with this. It says the origin of farming was not from a single population. That's what they found now. Now, this actually comes from a press release from the University College London and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So they've rolled this in, and I want you to listen to this. Basically, and this is what we all know because we've discussed it in ancient history, is around 10,000 years ago, we went from hunter-gatherers to farmers, and we knew all that. And there was multiple neighboring, they said, but not genetically distinct populations, according to research there by the UCL team, found all this stuff out. So they always thought, okay, this is the way it kind of rolled in. This is how it happened. There's an author that's involved in this at the UCL genetics team. His name's Dr. Garrett Henthal. And he said it had been widely assumed that these first farmers were from a single genetically homogeneous population. However, we found that there were deep genetic differences in these early farming populations, indicating very distinct ancestries.
Hmm.
So it's almost like, oh, wait a minute now, we're narrowing down where this come from.
Right.
Farnaz Broski and colleagues sequenced the DNA from four skeletons representing early Neolithic human remains from Iran's Zagos region. And that's the site of some of the oldest evidence of farming that we have to date. Now, these researchers did the genetic analysis, and they uncovered what's called, or what they consider, a previously uncharacterized population. And it's one highly distinct from ancient Neolithic Anatolians. Now, this population, they say, was often considered the most likely ancestors of European farmers. Now, they go on to say that this suggests that these Zagro-based farmers, the genetic sequences of which bear greater resemblance to modern-day Pakistani and Afghan populations, were not the ancestors of the first farmers in Europe. Instead, they likely split from ancient Neolithic Anatolian genomes more than 40,000 years ago.
Okay.
So you start pushing into that. Well, then we've got another one here. Professor Mark Thomas, that's the UCL Genetics, Evolution, and Environment, says, we know that farming technologies, including various domestic plants and animals, arose across the Fertile Crescent with no particular center. But to find that this region was made up of highly genetically distinct farming populations was something of a surprise. Now, he goes on to say that we estimated that they separated some 46 to 77,000 years ago. So they would almost certainly have looked different and spoken different languages. But it seems like we should be talking of a federal origin of farming. So it's almost like they learned in one area. There was a different genetic sequence of people, but it was in the same basic area. And then it seems that it spread. It said the switch from mobile hunting and gathering to sedentary farming first occurred around 10,000 years ago, like we talked about. But they said the most important behavioral transitions since humans first evolved in Africa some 200,000 years ago was that. So they believe that this was one of the big things. And they think now that they've got it narrowed down to where maybe it was this, that when people learned in different areas, it all came from one group of people.
Right.
So that's almost goes along the idea of Atlantis. Now, I know this is a stretch, and I'm reaching out, and they're not saying anything about Atlantis in this article.
Right.
This is me saying that. And I could go on and talk about what they discussed with the DNA and all this of things that they talked. And here's a really interesting thing. There's a professor, Stephen Shanahan, says that we've shown for the first time that different populations in different parts of the Fertile Crescent were coming up with similar solutions to finding a successful way of life in the new conditions created by the end of the last ice age. So if you look at that, it still makes it seem like, well, if multiple people are learning it, it's probably taught by other multiples, by people traveling. So one group actually knew it, and then it seems like they spread it, and it's almost like they all learned around the same time. It didn't blossom and then take a step a few years here, a few years there. It all kind of came about at the same time, which would imagine if you dispersed class. If you said, all right, everybody, class is out, y'all head out and go teach people.
Right.
So everybody starts learning in these steps because they come to the first group of people, they teach them. Next group of and it just kind of grows that way. So it's almost like DNA is kind of touching on what we've already assumed that we knew through what, you know, modern science calls pseudoscience or pseudohistory. It almost seems like there's a tie there somewhere. So,
well, that's, and on everybody came out of the Africa area because North America and South America was hit by an asteroid.
Mm-hmm.
Early Australia was hit by an asteroid. So there wasn't really a lot of people
that
even survived that.
Exactly.
That's the same reason why Africa is all the most megafauna.
Yes.
The biggest animals are on Africa because that was a place of the world that was spared.
Still has the largest mammals, and that's why.
Right. That's exactly right. That's pretty cool. Well, everybody hates going to the dentist. I know this. I imagine a few people, a couple weirdos out there like going. But everybody hates going. One of the biggest problems people hate going is because of getting their tooth pulled or having to get a root canal. But check this out. Stem cell dental fillings could be the end, Cam, of root canals.
That's something I never even thought about for stem cell.
I never knew that either. And they say that the days of having to listen to the terrible sound of a dentist's drill may soon be over. A normal root canal, if you don't know, is performed when a standard cavity covering filling has failed. For those who have been unfortunate enough to not need one, what the dentist does is he removes the soft pulp at the center of your tooth. That includes nerves, connective tissues, and blood vessels, and then the dentist cleans and seals off the tooth with a filling. It's an exceptionally common procedure. They say hundreds of millions of standard fillings are done every year, and about 10 to 15% of them fail and require a root canal. And root canals can, while preventing infection and clearing decay, still weaken the tooth. So all in all, they're not exactly anything anyone gets excited about getting. But recently, researchers at Harvard University and the University of Nottingham have developed a new type of filling that is made from a synthetic biomaterial that can be injected directly into your tooth. Therefore, you won't need to have a root canal.
That is awesome. So they just like drill a little hole and inject it?
I guess. It says this biomaterial stimulates stem cells to encourage the growth of dentin, which is the bony material that makes up most of your tooth, and causes the teeth to regrow where the decay has done all the damage. Now, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they say that they're experimenting with this, but it looks like they're coming a long way. And a guy named Adam Seeliz, he says that existing dental fillings are toxic to cells and therefore incompatible with pulp tissue inside the tooth. In cases of dental pulp disease and injury, a root canal is typically performed to remove the infected tissues. We have designed synthetic biomaterials that can be used similarly to dental fillings, and they can be placed directly in contact with the pulp tissue to stimulate the native stem cell population to repair, cause the regeneration of pulp tissue inside your tooth. So over the last couple of years, we've talked about, you know, guys that compete in MMA, they've been getting stem cells shot into their knees or their elbows, mm-hmm. and working wonders. We're having people that are using stem cells to get rid of other inflammations in other parts of the body. Now they're using stem cells to where you don't have to have a root canal anymore. Your tooth regrow.
Mm-hmm.
Man, this stem cell stuff is really exciting. I mean, I can't imagine where we're going to be 20 years from now. They're
going to
look back and be like, didn't President Bush, wasn't he against stem cell research on this? And be like, what was wrong with you people?
Yeah, right.
Right?
I'm just wondering, though, if it's going to be one of those things where you can go in now, kind of like an aftermarket thing, and have your old fillings removed and have the stem cell shot in there and it regrow what's already been removed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like, I wonder if there's a way to do that. I'm sure it's coming.
I'm sure it's coming, but it sounds to me like from the story that once it's dead, it's kind of dead.
Well, you say that.
But I don't know. No,
you know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe they're going to be able to grow it. I mean, we don't have any. This is the next step in the ability for them to make people live forever.
Right.
This is the very next step.
That would be awesome if you could just regrow all your teeth. You wouldn't have to do anything different.
All right, folks. This comes from our amigo over there at openminds.tv, Mr. Roger Marsh. And we're always talking about the different shapes of UFOs. And
yes,
this is a recent one that's a different shape. This is a V-shaped UFO that was reported hovering over a Memphis highway that a Tennessee witness at Memphis reported seeing not one, but two of these UFOs hanging in the sky over the highway. And for all you MUFON Network case aficionados, it's number 77441. And this is what it says. It says that the witness was driving to the Memphis airport along southbound I-55 at 3:30 a.m. on the 22nd of June 2016 near the Delta refinery when the incident occurred. And the witness states that as we got closer, I slowed and rolled my window down and stuck my head out to get a better view. It was not moving nor making any sound. I could not believe what I was seeing. The object was double the size of a large jet. The witness goes on to say that it seemed to be over twice the size of a 737 and just hanging there in the sky, shaped like a V made of two rectangles cut at the ends to make a point. This is the witness first thought to pull over and dig out a camera out of the luggage in the vehicle, but then thought it unwise to do on the expressway. Well, my hat's off to this witness for not causing a wreck and all this, but it says the traffic was light, but it was all tractor-trailer rigs. I tried adjusting my left rear view mirror, could not see it even when I looked back. Then off to my right, some distance away, we saw the same light pattern hanging in the southern sky, too far away to see any distinguishable features. Now, the witness, it says, attempted to sum up the location and size of the object. To the best of my memory, I would guess that the object was 1,000 to 1,500 feet up, gray in color, with white lights along the lower outer edges except for one red light at the back. I would guess that the legs of the V to be 30 feet to 50 feet square and 200 to 300 feet long, with the span at the back of the V about 150 feet. There were two protrusions that I could make out clearly on the bottom of the closest leg. One was a cylindrical shape, and the other was like an inverted fender well or a spare tire carrier. I am still befuddled about what it was. I swore to myself, I will never travel again without a camera ready. And to this day, I want to go back and look camera ready. Now, I've got one question about this.
Yeah.
The lights. It always talks about lights. It's hovering there with white lights and red lights. I don't know. Something about the lights always makes me feel like it's non-extraterrestrial. It's a terrestrial
I'm with
airplane. It's because something why that we would, do that with.
Why would they need lights on their craft? If just they to look
wanted,
cool?
If they wanted to be invisible and wanted to not be seen, why would you, exactly, why would you not do that? Why wouldn't you come, like we've said, as the wind or as a cloud? I mean, even that, you're like, it's just hard for me to believe that that's something that comes from out of this world whenever that's the constraints that we ourselves put on flying objects.
Right.
Or lights and all this stuff. So, I don't know. But it is very interesting because it's a giant V shape.
That is interesting. Man, that's pretty cool. Well, on today's show of Expanded Perspectives, we're going to be getting into one of the most iconic films ever made. It's the Patterson-Gimlin film. So stick with us, folks. We'll be back. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Roger Patterson was a unique man, an interesting entrepreneur, a kind of jack of all trades, but a master of none. He had been interested in the Bigfoot phenomenon since the early 1960s. He became obsessed with it. He would read anything he could find on the subject. He even was convinced that he actually seen some strange large footprints himself. Well, Roger told his friend about it, and his friend decided that he would like to accompany Roger on some of his upcoming excursions. His friend's name, by the way, was Bob Gimlin. And although the two didn't realize it yet, they would soon become one of the most influential names in the world of Bigfoot, Patterson Gimlin. So, Roger and Bob started going out into the woods in the Washington area to search for this elusive creature everybody was talking about. Often, they would be following up reports of sightings or footprints. Highly influenced by the writings of Dr. Ivan T. Sanderson, Patterson even compiled his own book entitled, Do Abominable Snowmen of America Really Exist? He published his book in 1966. At some point, early in the following year, Patterson talked to Bob, and they decided to make a film documentary on Bigfoot. So, Roger subsequently rented a movie camera for the purpose. He wished to find and film fresh footprints as evidence of the creature's existence. During late August and early September 1967, Patterson and Gimlin were exploring the Mount St. Helens area. While they were away, Al Hodgsons and Syl McCoy, friends in Willow Creek, California, phoned Patterson's home to report that footprints had been found near the Bluff Creek area. Now, Patricia Patterson, Roger's wife, took the message and gave it to her husband when he returned. The tracks, which were said to be one of three different sizes, had been found on a new logging road that was being built in the Bluff Creek region. Now, 9 years ago, this was an area of considerable Bigfoot activity. It was here, in 1958, that a man named Jerry Crew found large human-like footprints. A subsequent press release on Crew's find made the word Bigfoot the American name for the creature. So, Roger Patterson, when he heard the news, became really interested. Patterson contacted Gimlin, and the two men made plans to investigate the Bluff Creek report. Patterson purchased two 100-foot rolls of color movie film for the expedition. Patterson and Gimlin traveled to Bluff Creek area in a truck, taking with them three horses. By the time the men arrived at their destination, rain had all but destroyed the tracks. Roger and Bob were very disappointed. They had gone through all this trouble, purchasing this equipment, purchasing film, buying food, etc., and hauling these horses all the way up into the mountains to film these tracks, only to have Mother Nature snatch the plans out from underneath them. Well, after moping around for a little while, and realizing, well, they already spent the money, and they already hauled everything up this mountain, they might as well press on and see if they could find anything. After setting up camp near Bluff Creek itself, the men set out on horseback to explore the area. Patterson was intrigued with the scenery and autumn colors. He used 76 feet of his first film roll for general filming and shots of both himself and Gimlin. On Thursday evening, October 19th, 1967, the men set up their camp close to Bluff Creek. Gimlin arose early the next morning and rode out of camp while Patterson slept in. Gimlin arrived back at the camp at around 10 a.m. Patterson was not at the camp this time. He returned a little while later and asked Gimlin what area he had covered on his early ride. Gimlin told him where he had been, after which Patterson suggested that they re-explore an area they had previously explored. Gimlin agreed, and the men left around 12 p.m. Not long after, at about 1:30 p.m. that day, Friday, October 20th, 1967, Patterson and Gimlin spotted something that would change both of their lives forever.
Hey, look over there. There it is.
This was it.
Look, Roger.
The moment the two had been dreaming of. Finally, after all of their work, they finally found one. What they saw was a large, dark brown or black female creature standing about 6 to 7 feet tall and weighing an estimated 400 pounds, crossing a gravel sandbar down on Bluff Creek. Patterson's horse reared in alarm at the sight of the creature, bringing both the horse and the rider to the ground. Patterson was pinned below. Gimlin's horse and the pack horse were being led by Gimlin also reacted. The pack horse panicked, and Gimlin released its lead in order to control the horse he was still riding. Patterson, being an experienced horseman, quickly disengaged himself and grabbed his camera. The creature crossed the creek and walked along the opposite sandbar heading upstream. At one point, the creature turned and looked towards Patterson. The creature then hastened its pace somewhat as it continued its passage into a sparsely wooded area directly ahead. In the meantime, Gimlin, on horseback, rode slowly towards the creature. Gimlin crossed the creek and dismounted. He then observed the whole scene, rifle in hand, in case his friend was attacked by the creature. See, the men had previously agreed that under no circumstances would they try to shoot a Bigfoot unless to protect themselves or each other. The footage taken by Patterson shows the creature as it disappeared and then reappeared between trees in the distance. Gimlin wanted to immediately continue pursuit on horseback and proceeded to do so. Patterson, however, did not have his horse or his rifle and did not want to be left alone. He therefore yelled at Gimlin to return, which he did. Patterson collected his things, grabbed his rifle, and the two headed off. They followed the path taken by the creature. They found scuff marks in the gravel and in the creek bed, which may have indicated the creature ran when it was out of the men's sight. They continued up the creek for a considerable distance and observed a rock with a wet half footprint on the surface. From that point, the path led up into the mountains. The men then returned to the film site and examined the path the creature had taken along the sandbar. They observed and filmed, on the second film roll, the creature's footprints in the soil and later made plaster casts of the left and right foot. Now, in that part of Bluff Creek, there is a sandy clay soil with a little bluish-gray tinge. This type of soil holds footprints remarkably well for a long period of time. The cast that they made of these footprints measured 14.5 inches long by 6 inches wide. Gimlin jumped off of a stump to see how far his footprints would sink into the soil in comparison with the creature's prints. The results were that the creature's footprints were much deeper. Patterson also took movie footage of this experiment, together with footage of horse prints alongside the creature's prints, and the men's cast-making activities. Patterson was eager to get his film of the creature developed to ensure that he had, in fact, caught the creature on the film. See, this is back in the day before digital, so you didn't really know if you captured it yet. At this point, Gimlin stated, "We weren't sure from Roger stumbling and falling down on that sandbar and then getting up and running. We didn't even have an idea if we even had anything on the film at that time. In fact, it was pretty doubtful that we had anything at all." Well, they formed a plan, and they decided to airship the film to Al Diatley, which was Patterson's brother-in-law in Yakima, for immediate processing. They both decided to wait to hear from Patterson's brother-in-law to see if they did indeed capture the beast on film or not. If they didn't, they would stay longer and try again. Patterson and Gimlin headed out to an air shipping facility and shipped the film to Al Diatley. The two men then contacted a reporter for the Times Standard newspaper at Eureka, to whom they related their experience in considerable detail. The article appeared in the newspaper the following day, October 21st, 1967. The men then immediately headed back to their campsite. By the time they arrived, bad weather was closing in. By about midnight, it was raining heavily. Fearing a possible landslide on the Bluff Creek Road, Patterson and Gimlin decided to get out of the area. They packed up and left for Yakima at around 4 a.m. They experienced great difficulties getting out of that area. The Bluff Creek Road had caved away, so they had to take a different route, the Onion Mountain route. They eventually made it home safe and sound. Al Diatley picked up the film at the Seattle airport on the morning of Saturday, October 21st, 1967. He had the film processed at the Alpha Scene Laboratory in Seattle and returned to his home in Yakima that same day. Patterson and Gimlin arrived at Yakima sometime on Sunday morning, October 22nd, 1967. When Roger arrived at his brother-in-law's house, he took Roger down into the basement to watch the now-developed film. When they saw what was on the film, their jaws dropped. He did it. He captured on film what so many said was not a real creature. He soon told Bob as well, and some other researchers in the area. They all wanted to see it too, so Roger arranged to have secret viewings of the film. The film of the creature apparently impressed these other researchers. Nothing appeared to indicate that Patterson or Gimlin were being untruthful. Patterson and Gimlin's Bigfoot sighting experience at Bluff Creek was highly unique for three main reasons. First, there were two witnesses to the event, so their stories could be cross-checked against each other. Second, there was photographic evidence in the form of a movie Patterson took, which could later be analyzed. And third, the men had plaster casts of the footprints made by the creature to further confirm the sighting. Moreover, many of the footprints at the film site remained intact and could be seen, photographed, and cast by other researchers. All of this evidence was certainly very credible. Important questions, however, remained unanswered on the credibility of Patterson and Gimlin themselves. These questions were diligently pursued by a man named René Dehinden. Now, Dehinden attacked the issue from a negative perspective. In other words, he looked for any evidence that the film was a hoax. He got together with John Green, and they researched the backgrounds of both Patterson and Gimlin. Nothing was found to indicate these men had hoaxed the film. Dehinden and John Green convinced Patterson that the scientific community in British Columbia, Canada, would probably be the most receptive to the new film evidence. This advice was based on the fact that people in British Columbia were very familiar with the Bigfoot or Sasquatch phenomenon. Dehinden and Green had been cultivating this region with their research for many years in hopes of gaining government backing for their endeavors. Patterson was further persuaded by a telephone call from Don Abbott, who promised good scientific representation for a viewing of the film. A scientific viewing was consequently scheduled for October 26, 1967. On Monday, October 23rd, just a few days before,
Abbott informed the newspapers in Victoria and Vancouver, British Columbia, about the film. Further, a man named Jack Webster, a Vancouver radio station personality, interviewed Patterson and Gimlin on the air shortly after their arrival in Vancouver. As news of the film spread, official word from the scientific community was anxiously awaited. October 26 couldn't arrive fast enough, and the film was shown at the University of British Columbia. Two screenings were conducted. The first screening was given to the university scientists only. The second screening was to university scientists and Don Abbott and Frank Beebe. Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin were at both sessions to answer any questions. They also showed the audience the cast of the footprints that they found during the filming. The university scientists were under strict orders not to comment one way or the other on the authenticity of this film. The museum people were not restrained. Frank Beebe, although impressed with the film, implied the strong likelihood of a hoax. Don Abbott, he didn't give his opinion at all. The film became very popular, and it seemed that the scientific community was doing everything they could to disprove the film as a hoax. But there still was a small faction of scientists and researchers claiming that this was authentic. Several of the scientists concentrated on the creature's movement or locomotion. They concluded that the creature was extremely heavy. Great weight was indicated by how the creature's arms swung and how its knees bent when its body weight came onto its feet. They stated that the bulk can be simulated, but not the massive weight. The scientists were also impressed with the creature's apparent muscle mass. The Institute agreed to do some biomechanical work on the film, but never proceeded. Further, it never provided any official written opinions on its preliminary conclusions. To this day, it is the single most reviewed and studied piece of film ever, even more than the assassination of JFK. Almost 50 years later, and still, people can't make up their mind what Patterson and Gimlin filmed up there that day, if it was real, or just a guy in a really elaborate suit. The North American Science Institute report, towards a resolution of the Bigfoot phenomenon, prepared by a guy named Jeff Glickman, who's a forensic examiner, was released in June 1998. The main report findings applicable to the Patterson-Gimlin may be summarized as follow. 1. Measurements of the creature appear to be about 7 feet tall. Waist seems to be about 81.3 inches. Chest, around 83 inches. Weight, over 400 pounds. Length of arms, 43 inches. Length of legs, 40 inches. The length of the creature's arms is virtually beyond human standards. The length of the creature's legs is unusual by human standards. Nothing was found indicating the creature was a man in a costume. Hand movement indicated that it has flexible hands. Preliminary findings indicated that the forward motion part of the creature's walking pattern could not be duplicated by a human being. Rippling of the creature's flesh or fat on its right side was observed, indicating that a costume is highly improbable. The creature's feet undergo flexation like a real foot would, so this eliminates the possibility of a fabricated solid foot apparatus. The appearance and sophistication of the creature's musculature are beyond costumes used in the entertainment industry at that time. No uniformity in hair, texture, length, and coloration is inconsistent with sophisticated costumes used in the entertainment industry. So by all accounts, they found the film is genuine.
But it doesn't end there, you see. On a cool, clear day in Yakima, Washington, on January 30th, 1999, the Bigfoot world was hit with a blind side that they never saw coming. Just a month after watching the Fox television special, World's Greatest Hoaxes, Secrets Finally Revealed, a man by the name of Bob Hieronymus made a statement to to the Yakima newspaper, through his lawyer, of course, then went like this. I'm telling the truth. I'm tired after 37 years. See, Hieronymus, who claimed to be friends with Roger Patterson, and was actually a neighbor of Roger's, and even had a horse or two boarded with Roger at his stable. You see, Roger was a horse trainer. And as it turns out, one of the horses that Patterson and Gimlin took to Bluff Creek in 67 was, in fact, Bob Hieronymus's. But Hieronymus goes on to claim that he rode with Patterson and Gimlin to Bluff Creek, was helped into a suit by both men that he claimed Roger Patterson made himself. He claims that Patterson made the suit himself by skinning a dead horse and gluing fur from an old fur coat on the horse hide. It was in three parts, a head, torso, and legs, that felt like big rubber boots that went up to his waist. He thought the feet were made of old house slippers. The suit, he said, weighed 20 or 25 pounds. He then says that he simply walked out to a predetermined area, and presto, Bigfoot is real. My quote, not his. Bob went so far as to take and pass a lie detector test on live TV. PAX television channel, Lie Detector, show aired May 17th of 2005, and it was hosted by Rolanda Watts. Now, the test administered was by a leading polygraph expert, Dr. Ed Gelb. And afterwards, Dr. Gelb said that proving once and for all that along with past polygraphs by serial killers like Ted Bundy, Hieronymus believes he was the man in the suit to the degree that he so too was able to pass the polygraph. Now, Russ Bohannon, a longtime friend, says that Bob Hieronymus revealed this hoax to him privately in 1968 or 1969. And even Bob's relatives, his nephew and his mother, both claim to have seen an ape suit in Hieronymus's car. His mother Opal said she saw the suit 2 days after the film was shot. But a quick debunking of this story leads you to the fact that Bob Hieronymus is only 6 feet tall. He claims he did this for a big payola, and he has been known around town as a fella looking for easy money his entire life, and there's also a part that he's never been able to produce, the said suit. Now, Patterson's widow has said that he's lying. Bob Gimlin says that he's lying. And no one can corroborate Hieronymus. No one can back up the claim that he accompanied Patterson and Gimlin. Now, there are various witnesses near Bluff Creek that are living today that claim that Patterson and Gimlin were accompanied by no one. None of these people ever saw Hieronymus with these two men. And Hieronymus doesn't know where they went exactly or even which route they took. But that brings us to the suit. Because you see, on August 16th of 2002, on a radio station in Charlotte, North Carolina, called WBT AM, a fellow named Philip Morris, owner of Morris Costumes, a Charlotte custom costume business started in the early 1960s that Philip grew into a massive empire, and many of his costumes, of course, have appeared in Hollywood films, and he has props and stage products. Well, he came forward and he made the claim that the Patterson Gimlin film depicts a man wearing a gorilla suit, and that gorilla suit had been hand sewn in the basement of his home. He says that in 1967, a man called and identified himself as Roger Patterson and said he was an old rodeo cowboy and he wanted to buy a gorilla suit for a gag. Well, Morris Costumes was one of the few companies at the time making, relatively speaking, inexpensive gorilla suits. So Patterson paid up front, shipping and handling, for the suit and shelled out $435. Mr. Morris said, I didn't think it was that real big of a deal. It was just another sale. Patterson, he claims, later called and asked him how to make it more realistic. Morris told him, use a stick to extend the arms, brush the fur to cover the zipper, and wear football pads to make the shoulders bigger. He claims he never heard from Roger Patterson again. He also says that even after he saw the Patterson-Gimlin film on television, that he refused to go public. He claimed that it was because he didn't want to expose a fellow illusionist. Mr. Morris said, "In my mind, it was a magic trick." Well, as for the creature's walk, Mr. Morris was quoted in saying, "The Bigfoot researchers say that no human can walk that way in the film." I say, "Oh, yes, they can. When you are wearing long clown's feet, you can't place the ball of your foot down first. You have to put your foot down flat. Otherwise, you stumble. Another thing, when you put on the gorilla head, you can only turn your head maybe a quarter of the way. And to look behind you, you have got to turn your head and your shoulders and your hips. Plus, the shoulder pads in the suit are all in the way of the jaw. That's why the Bigfoot turns and looks the way he does in the film. He has to twist his entire upper body." Well, 37 years after the original was shot, National Geographic shot a recreation of this film at a place called Cow Camp. So on October 4th, 2004, near Rimrock Lake, the shenanigans began. I say shenanigans because the suit provided by Mr. Morris, mind you, after 37 more years to perfect your Bigfoot gorilla suit coat craft, looked absolutely nothing like the original Patterson-Gimlin film. So bad that Bigfoot researcher Daniel Perez wrote National Geographic's producer Noel Doxter and said that the suit used in this recreation was in no way similar to what was depicted in the film. And also, seemingly knowing that he was now caught in his BS story, Morris would not consent to the release of the video to National Geographic. The recreation sponsor claiming that he had not had adequate time to prepare and that the month was in the very middle of his busy season. However, he has not attempted to create a suit like this since that time. Now, the author of the book, The Making of Bigfoot, The Inside Story, Mr. Greg Long, has received probably the most hate, it seems. He was the man that put all these people together, interviewing and researching all the angles of this story. But having not read this book, I can only speak on what reviews and online discussion I've seen. From what I can find, it seems most believe that Greg went into this story, not objectively, but with a point of not believing any of this and trying to discredit the men involved in the sighting in order to prove his point. But I will reserve my judgment until I've read Mr. Long's work myself. But with a story like this, we can't leave out one little tidbit that was said to have spawned it all. The story of the man, Raymond Wallace. See, Ray Wallace was a logger for much of his life, but was also involved in road construction throughout much of Oregon, Washington, and California. Wallace settled down, started his family up there in a little town called Toledo, Washington in 1961, and see, it was at his job site, and actually an employee of his, that found a set of tracks in Humboldt County in 1958 that the Humboldt Times of Eureka, California first coined the term Bigfoot. He was also the man that Mark Chavorsky, editor of Strange Magazine, who promoted Wallace's claim that he had tipped off Patterson exactly where to look for a Bigfoot. Now, Mark wrote that Roger Patterson came over dozens of times pumping me on this Bigfoot, speaking of Ray, and Ray Wallace explained to another Bigfoot enthusiast and researcher, Dennis Pilchus, back in 1982, that he said that I felt sorry for Roger Patterson. He told me he had cancer of the lymph glands and he has desperately broke and wanted to try and get something where he could have a little more income. Well, he went down there exactly where I told him. Said, "You go down there and hang around the bank and stay up there and watch that spot." Well, Ray's son Michael later told the story that Ray was in possession of what he called large, poorly crafted, obviously fake wooden feet. It was Michael's story. And also, according to Ray Wallace's family, that Ray's brother Wilbur and his nephew, Mac, used these same wooden feet to stamp tracks all around Northern California as a prank. It has even been reported that Ray created feces samples and hair samples, which Ray and some of his family left in the wood for these Bigfoot researchers to find. Ray said he created these hair samples by using hair he collected from bison that he kept on his farm near Toledo, Washington. Now, many believe that Ray had a degree of involvement in this film, yet others, like Mr. Lauren Coleman, have written that the real reason of Ray's involvement was because Roger Patterson was an early Bigfoot investigator, and that Roger would have only deemed it natural to seek out and interview older Bigfoot investigators, which included Ray, because of the 1958 Bluff Creek tracks. Now, having never met Mr. Bob Gimlin myself, but knowing several researchers that have, and that have spent personal time with him, they all say the same thing. He believes what they saw was real. He waited years before discussing it with anyone. So much so that his first Bigfoot conference was in Willow Creek in California in 2003. That is enough for me to keep an open mind about the video and keep pushing forward. There is always more than meets the eye in any story, and the trick is knowing what your own eyes believe. Do your own research, come to your own conclusions, but please, never stop searching.
Back with Expanded Perspectives. It's a strange story, you know, like I've talked about it all the time. You know, there are days when I watch this footage, and everybody that's listening to this has seen it, where I'm like, man, that looks fake. It's got to be a guy in a suit, right? But then there's other times I look at it and be like, man, that doesn't look like a suit. You know, and they talk about, you know, the story of the guy making that a horse hair and stuff. Man, that does not look like a horse hair suit to me.
Hieronymus claims that, yeah, that Roger Patterson made it all, and it's three pieces. There's a bunch more, and I guess that's probably what we need to get into. There's a lot more to it. I mean, we could go on probably literally discussing this film for 2 or 3 hours,
yeah,
of the angles, because we could get into the angles of Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, of Grover Krantz. We could get into Gordon Strasberg, the stuff that they've talked about.
Right.
There are tons of people that favor this film that is a scientific favorable. Then there's tons of people that are like, there's no way it's real. I mean, there's Bill Munns is a special effects guy and all this stuff that's talked about it. And he was, I believe, one of the guys that actually worked on 2001. He's the guy that I believe made the space, the ape outfits and things. So people would come to him and talk to him, right, about it. There are tons and tons of this stuff. But if you really look at it, it's like what you and I discussed, that we didn't want to get too deep into the character assassination, if you will, of Roger Patterson.
I agree, yeah.
A lot of guys went after Roger because they were like, look, this guy, the camera he rented, he didn't bring back. They filed charges on him. Then he brought the camera back. He was fined and all this stuff. And they
He's
said
a con
he was,
man.
That's what they claim and all these things. And look, maybe he was, maybe he was not. I didn't meet Roger. Roger died in 1972.
Right.
You know, we don't have anything to do with that. Like we talked about, and I even brought up, I've never met Bob Gimlin. Now, we know several guys that have actually been in studio with us that have met Bob Gimlin, mm-hmm, and spent time with Bob. And they all tell us that Bob is a stand-up dude, and he believes what he saw is real. That goes back into things that you always say. Does it matter if it's real or not? It affected you so much that you believe it's real. So in his, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, I do
he
know.
He believes that. We didn't go after any of the character assassination because I don't believe it's thing. We always talk about ad hominem attack whenever people start bringing up these things is instantly in order to discredit you. They can't discredit the video, so they discredit the man that shot the video.
Right.
The man is not under the scrutiny. That's not what we're looking at. What we're looking at is what that video tells us. Now, like you said, there's times that I'm with it, and there's times that I wake up some mornings and I'm like, there's no way that's real. There's no way that's real. Because like I've told you, it's funny. That's what we all think of Bigfoot now. Maybe Bigfoot really doesn't move that way. Maybe it would have, if they would have crawled on all fours, where we would have been then. You know, we don't know. There's a lot. It's strange. What's funny to me, though, is they claim that this sprang up in 1958, but they're not saying that the tales of Bigfoot sprang up in 1958.
That's true.
Just this.
Or the word Bigfoot.
The word Bigfoot sprang up then in 1958 and all that stuff. But we do know that there are accounts, we've covered them years ahead of this whole thing. So is there a possibility? I guess there could be a possibility of there being this being real. There could be a possibility of this being real. But on the same hand, there's also the same possibility of it being fake.
I agree.
That weight is saying it's still 50-50. I can't release it more than 50-50. I haven't seen enough documentation or videos personally of these scientists that break it all down in body length and all this stuff for me to believe, because here's the thing to me, if you could break it all down in body length and they say, okay, this isn't a human. Well, it wouldn't be a human unless you know the exact size. We still don't know the exact size. We can estimate it.
Right. It's estimated,
but it's all estimated off what's in the, because you don't know the exact size of what's, they get close and all these things, this, that, and the distance. We don't know all of these facts. A lot of them are assumptions or mathematical assumptions. They give us close numbers, but they don't give us exactness. So that right there leaves a loophole.
You're right.
If it was in court, somebody would be found not guilty because there's too much in that video that's loopholed. So with that right there, I'm still 50-50. I want it to be real, but I don't know that I can put all my eggs in one basket of it being real.
I agree with you. I mean, I've even heard that, Gimlin thinks what he saw is real is because Roger Patterson and Bob Hieronymus or anybody else, they pulled a prank on Gimlin.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a perfect way. Well, I'm going to bring somebody with me. And I'm not going to tell them. That way, when I shoot the film of my buddy in the suit, my friend that doesn't know, he's going to, back up my story and go, yeah, I saw it. But I don't know if that's true, because I will say this film was shot almost 50 years ago. And with all the technology we have with computers,
mm-hmm.
Photoshop, Lightroom, Premiere, whatever software, they still haven't been able to prove or catch any, hoaxes in it.
Any shenanigans in that video.
They cannot prove it. Whatever, it doesn't mean that it's still a Sasquatch, but whatever it is, that film was not altered.
Yes, that's exactly. It was whatever it was filming looked good the first take, because you got to know what you just brought up. If I was trying to fool you and had somebody else set up, it has to work in the first take.
Yeah.
Or now you're privy to it.
Exactly.
And I have to know that you're not going to fire a rifle round at it.
Yes.
Because I don't want to take you out there and then have my son dressed up and you kill my son in a monkey suit. And I'm like, dude, this was just a trick.
It's just a prank. Joke.
You just blew his brains out. Like, you don't want that to happen.
You're exactly right.
There's a lot that goes in. And that right there, you're taking a chance. Because Bob has said before, and like we covered on the Elite Show, that he wished he'd have just shot it and drug it out of the woods.
Yeah, man. And like you've talked about to me, too, privately. I mean, it's not like Gimlin made a lot of money off this.
This really didn't make a lot of money. Now, I know Bob didn't make any money. It is pretty much Roger's brother-in-law is the one that got control of the whole thing, especially after Roger died.
Right.
Bob's not made any money. And like we talked about in the news article on the Elite Show, there's a lot more that goes into the way Bob feels. So I don't know, man. This is one of those things that we've never had another Bigfoot sighting, I don't think, that's ever come close to this. And I think that's the problem with it, is if there was multiple rough videos and then one clear one and we had this one, and then would be one thing. But the very first video that we've ever been introduced to is near perfect.
Right.
From 1967, I think, is what sticks in most people's craw. I think that's the problem most people have with it. I know I do. And I know for the fact that, people are always like, well, they couldn't do that back in 67. But you start really researching these old special effects guys. They're like, you could do it. It would cost a lot of money, but you could fake it. Well, then that goes back into the money situation. Now, these guys were broke. These were guys who were just old cowboys.
Right.
Like, where are you going to get that money and hope? Because you never made it back.
Right.
You don't know what you're going to do. So here I am talking like I'm on the fence about it, but then it sounds like I'm all for it. I'm like, I still don't know.
See, that's the problem. You go back and forth. And I think most people you meet, that's the one question they always ask you. Is like, Patterson-Gimlin film, you think it's fake or real? They always ask me that. And I'm always like, man, I don't know. I'm undecided.
There's one that I always stick with. And I always think about this. Rick Baker is the guy that created Harriet from Harry and the Hendersons.
Okay.
Okay, he's the guy that created that stuff. And he's created a bunch of stuff like that from his studios. And I always remember there's a quote out there of Rick Baker's that says it looked like cheap fake fur. That's what he's always said. To him, it looked like cheap fake fur. That's always stuck with me, as a guy that's seen those creations on video multiple times and has worked with them multiple times, and that's the one thing that he says.
Yeah, that's you got to take his word, right?
Well, you do. Now, like we've talked about with Bill Munns, you know, he believes different ways about the whole thing too. So I don't know. It is, but the whole special effects deal is like, that's what sticks with me.
Well, that is really cool. It's one of the most popular videos of all time of a cryptid creature. I'm glad we finally got to talk about it. If you have any stories of your own that you would like to share, don't forget you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call us directly, 817-945-3828. Well, that's about all the time we have for the free show. We'll be speaking to you elite members on Thursday. For everybody else, stay out of trouble. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.